Broadcasting from the Unshackled Studios in Melbourne, this is Wilms Front, brought to you by theunshackled.net. Now here's Tim Wilms.
Hello everybody and welcome to this week's Wilms Front interview program on this Sunday, the 10th of March, 2024. We are broadcasting live on the Wilms Front YouTube channel, the Wilms Front Odyssey channel, and the Wilms Front Rumble channel. It is 8:30 p.m. here in Melbourne, Victoria, starting a little bit earlier tonight because my guest is from New Zealand, which is 2 hours ahead of us, where it is 10:30 p.m. and at the moment is ahead of Australia on many fronts with its based new government led by National Party Prime Minister Christopher Luxon, New Zealand First Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, and ACT Party leader David Seymour. They've begun the process of making New Zealand great again after making Ardern go away. New Zealand's far left triggered mainstream media, by contrast, is in its death throes. So to celebrate the death of fake news in New Zealand, my guest is William McGimpsey, previously known as the Zeitgeist New Zealand, which publishes clips of the appalling left-wing bias of New Zealand's mainstream media, which myself and Dewey DeBoer used to play on our Trad Tasman Talk program. William is now a contributor like me to New Zealand's Reality Check Radio, one of a number of alternate independent media outlets that is going from strength to strength, catering to the ignored Kiwis. Dewey DeBoer is also a host there as well with the Dialogue. William, welcome to Wilms Front.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here, even if it is a little bit past my bedtime.
Yes, it's quite late over there, so I definitely appreciate you coming on. Now, obviously, I'm having you on for, well, a celebratory reason. So the good news this week is that News Hub, or as myself and Dewey used to call it, Fake News Hub, is shutting down at the end of June, and this follows their axing of the project, the New Zealand edition, at the end of last year, which one of the hosts was a man by the name of Patrick Gower. And to set the scene for our Australian viewers, Patrick Gower is like a combination of Lisa Wilkinson and Waleed Ali combined. He is like the worst of the worst. He once went traveled to Vermont to stalk Bernie Sanders on his morning walk. That's the type of leftist fanboy he is.
Yeah, well, I mean, Patrick Gower, I think one of his worst escapades was when he tried to interview Stefan Molyneux and Lauren Southern, and they made mincemeat out of him live on TV. That still gets brought up on Twitter. I don't think he's ever really... Well, he had sort of recovered, but I mean, it was pretty hard to live down. And he was trying to do a hit piece on them, and it didn't really come off. He ended up doing a hit piece on himself. It was sort of the ultimate self-own. They started talking to him about race and IQ and these sorts of things, and he just had no answers on that front. Probably never thought about it in his life, living in the liberal bubble, where they don't talk about those sorts of things. So he just didn't have any answers for it, apart from to accuse them of going off on a rant.
Though for some reason he became the golden boy of News Hub, which is, so it was launched in 2016 as replacing, or being as the name suggests, the News Hub for TV3, which is one of your free-to-air networks. And so it was sold as that. But obviously, 8 years later, it hasn't worked out. I'll allow you to explain, well, how it basically it killed itself.
Yeah, well, so New Zealand's mainstream media scene, there's basically two main channels. There's, in terms of news, two main mainstream news providers. And one of them is TVNZ, so Channel 1. in New Zealand, which is publicly owned, but is partly commercially funded and has some public funding as well for from things like New Zealand On Air and stuff like that. And the other one is Channel 3. And that's the one that News Hub is on. It's on Channel 3. So for most of New Zealand's existence, or most of the time we've had television, we've just had one state broadcaster giving us one network news channel, network news at 6 o'clock. But when Channel 3 came in, it provided some competition for, in terms of the 6 o'clock news. But it never really reached parity with One News in terms of its viewership. So, I mean, I was just looking at some numbers today, and during the COVID lockdown, for example, so there's 5 million people in New Zealand, and about 1 million watched the daily 6 o'clock news during the COVID lockdowns. 750,000 per night were watching One News, 250,000 News Hub. And now that difference might be a bit bigger than what it was for a lot of the time, but in general, for the whole period that One News and Three News and then later News Hub are operating, One News has dominated the ratings. But so I think there's sort of two, so it's been an underdog from the beginning, but there's really two reasons why it's failed. And one is just changing technology, and the other is media bias. So in terms of changing technology, it used to be the main mediums people got their news from were newspapers, radio, and the television news, the 6 o'clock news broadcast. But obviously with the development of the internet and social media, the range of ways people get news has proliferated. And so now there's online news sites like stuff.co.nz, which is like an online newspaper. There's social media like YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, where a lot of people get news. And there's also online streaming services like Netflix and Amazon Prime and other things like that. And there's also the on-demand services that the main channels run as well. And so because of this sort of this proliferation of different media, the ratings for the main, and so people are getting their news in different ways. They're not all watching the 6 o'clock news like they were, and the advertising revenue has fallen. And given that News Hub is the little brother and always has been the little brother to One News, it's no surprise that it would go out of business first. So that's the technological cause. You know, the other cause is the media bias, right? So surveys for a long time now, predating the COVID pandemic, have said that, you know, there's a problem with media bias in New Zealand. And I think, and I've seen evidence to say that that's similar in a lot of countries, similar in the States, probably similar in Australia. I don't know, you could tell me. But there's evidence that journalists lean to the left in terms of their own personal political views. There's evidence that public perceptions of bias in the media are very strong. And there's, as a result, there's been falling trust in media for quite a long time. But when the COVID pandemic came around, the Ardern government, first of all, they pumped millions of dollars, almost $100 million into advertising, perhaps more, for the to roll out their COVID
United Against COVID-19, it was called.
Yes, and encouraging everyone to get the vaccination and wear the masks and all the rest of it. So that's a huge amount of money. And this is at a time with falling revenues. So the government became a significant contributor to their revenue. And then they also initiated something called the Public Interest Journalism Fund, which is a $55 million fund that funded various reporting projects and various news projects. But it came with strings attached. And this was sort of kept secret from the public for a long time, but due to some intrepid citizen journalism from the likes of Philip Crump, aka Thomas Cranmer in New Zealand, along with some other people, myself included, it came to public attention that they had to cover, in order to get the money, they had to sign up to an agreement that meant they had to cover treaty issues in New Zealand, I'm referring to the Treaty of Waitangi here, and Maori issues in a certain way. And it was a way that was in lockstep, really, with the Labor government's view that the treaty was a partnership. And this is the sort of legal and philosophical underpinning to their program of co-governance that they brought in, which was really undemocratic. It resulted in Maori representatives from the various iwi, the various tribes in New Zealand, getting places on local councils that didn't have to be voted in and couldn't be voted out and things like that. And so, you know, for a variety of reasons, just the money being, I mean, they were biased anyway. Journalists are left wing. They were getting this massive infusion of COVID money to do COVID advertising on behalf of the government, which, you know, and you can only think if you're a news company that that much money is going to curry favor and influence the way you cover issues. You don't want to say things unfavorable about one of your biggest funders, do you? And then the Public Interest Journalism Fund with strings attached. And so this just increased the perceptions of bias amongst the public to the point where the already low and falling trust in mainstream journalism, including in News Hub, just fell even further. And people don't watch it. People gave up watching it. People are getting their news online. People are getting their news from YouTube. They're getting the news from other places, getting news from Reality Check Radio. And so, I mean, that's why News Hub going out of business.
We had something similar here during the COVID lockdowns by our so-called Liberal government under Scott Morrison. It was called the... it was the $5 million Regional and Small Publishers Innovation Fund. So to keep open all of those regional newspapers and websites. It's sold that we're supporting the Fourth Estate, but obviously there's a quid pro quo whenever the government doles out money to... Well, it's basically a bailout. That's what you'd call it. And it's something that I call the politico media complex. I mean, all of the mainstream media journalists, they want to be, well, they especially all wanted to be at those COVID press conferences, because and obviously the government ministers give them all the leaks in advance. It's and obviously that's the reason why also the media was eager to push the lockdown propaganda, because what else can people do but watch TV?
Yeah, for a long time, media, not just in New Zealand and not just in Australia, but in most democratic countries, have sort of become or styled themselves as a sort of Praetorian Guard, you know, like defenders of the faith of liberal democracy. And they're here not to just report the news, but to defend a certain ideology that they view, or at least they tell us, that is necessary to the functioning of liberal democracy. But is it really democratic to be telling people in a democracy what to think or how they should think? And especially when you're painting them in such a way as that to make their opinions seem illegitimate. And this is a problem we have right across society and in the major opinion-making institutions of society, in academia and in the media and in the public service, and increasingly in the corporate world as well. There's an ideology that's being pushed.
We have the white corporates as well. I mean, we had all the corporations here, most of them line up to support the failed Aboriginal Voice to Parliament referendum last year.
That's right. And they use, for a long time, they've used political correctness to enforce their ideological hegemony, right? So if you subscribe to ideas they didn't accept, they called you a racist or a sexist or a homophobe or a xenophobe. you know, lots of isms and phobias. And that was enough for a long time to intimidate people, because you could get, you know, you could get lose your job if you had accusations of those type of words thrown at you. And many people did lose their jobs and have their reputations destroyed and have their careers destroyed because they believed in and spoke ideas that fell outside this artificial mainstream that was maintained by the media and these other institutions. But that system of thought control is giving way now. And part of the reason that it's giving way is the proliferation of the different ways that people are getting news and the proliferation of different providers, like you, Tim, like this show we're on now. Shows like this are proliferating all over the Western world. People want to get their information in different ways and they want to see different perspectives. And so they're seeking out small internet providers to give them those perspectives. And, you know, mainstream news like NewsHub can't compete.
And there was, obviously, there has been a lot of the journalist and academia class. They've been in tears that this is so bad for our democracy, the death of NewsHub, and tried to lobby the government for another bailout, I think that my reading is that government ministers said gave a good eulogy to NewsHub, but they're not going to throw some bailout money.
Well, not for NewsHub, I don't think, but TVNZ is a different story. And I don't know if you want to move on to TVNZ now, but TVNZ have also announced cuts of several shows, in some ways several iconic shows that are sort of cultural touchstones in New Zealand, like Fair Go, for example, which is a show where people send in complaints about being ripped off by various people and the reporters go after them and explain what's happened and try and get things.
Do you think that maybe TVNZ has done that to sort of to try and get a headline themselves? Because our ABC does this here, which is, it's, though our national broadcaster, it's fully government funded. If they want more money, they threaten to axe like local news, that sort of thing. Do you think that TVNZ, they're sort of, rather than cutting the fat, like the middle managers, all that sort of thing, they're going for the iconic shows?
Maybe. It does have a sort of a whiff about it of trying to shake down the government for more money. But I couldn't say for sure. I mean, I'm not on the inside of that discussion, but it's definitely a possibility. I think, none of these things are really simple. There are, I think, some legitimate arguments for, public funding of journalism. But it has to be on the proviso that it's unbiased and fairly reflects the attitudes and values and worldviews of ordinary New Zealanders, and rather than being a sort of enforcing an elite ideological consensus on a population that doesn't want it. And where they've moved to now and it's not just the media, this is the government as well, that they're really trying to delegitimize people who disagree with their the elite ideology. And that's really just unacceptable in my view.
Well, your mainstream media, they got massively triggered, and they were like, "How dare you?" When Winston Peters, he's fourth government. So, throughout his career with New Zealand First, he's been with National now twice and Labour twice. At the coalition press conference, he said to the mainstream media outlets who were trying to stitch him up, "You've all been bought," and they really hated that. "Oh, we've got such good standards, we're not going to let the government intimidate us." And it was very Trumpian. And this is another thing why people don't respect the mainstream media anymore. Like, they always act like they're the moral arbiters, but they hate scrutiny themselves, particularly that people can now talk back to them on Twitter, X, and a lot of them always complain about cyberbullying, cyber stalking, that sort of thing. They really don't like it when they're held up to the same scrutiny.
Yeah, well, I mean, in some ways, social media is the democratization of media, isn't it? I mean, it turns people who are interested in media from passive consumers into active participants. And rather than merely passively consuming what Paddy Gower or any other journalist says, people can now log on to their Twitter account and reply to them and say, look, that's bullshit, Paddy. I don't believe in that. And then point out why he's wrong. And Paddy Gower doesn't like having to deal with that, and nor do a lot of the other ones. And so what we're getting now is lots of complaints, like you say, of, you know, bullying, cyberbullying, all that sort of thing. So when I disagree with some of these journalists on Twitter, then, you know, I'm a big, bad, evil racist engaging in cyberbullying. But when they, for years and years, for decades, engaged in lecturing ordinary people about being racist and sexist and homophobes, from a much bigger platform than I have, or any of us have with our Twitter accounts, that was okay. Complete hypocrisy. Complete hypocrisy. You're the bullies and you're getting your comeuppance. And there's no reason people like me need to be apologetic towards you.
It was quite, I would say, quite inspiring that at your general election, despite the entire mainstream media pushing Jacinta Ardern's, we'll call it propaganda, because obviously the image that is beamed to the world of Jacinta Ardern, or she's Dame Jacinta Ardern now, is that she was the great progressive, big, kind prime minister. And obviously in New Zealanders were living under her regime, which not only locked the country down for 2 years, but ran the economy into the ground. Despite all of the news media being in her favour, the academia, or all of the chattering classes, she decided to bail in the end because she knew she'd be chucked out into a landslide. So the voters, they could see through it all, which I think is a great credit to them. I mean, obviously, I think that they put up with her COVID extreme. It was even more extreme, her lockdowns, than Victoria.
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream media anointed her, but the people rejected her. And so it just shows that their power has waned. It's, you know, for the last few decades now, governments in New Zealand have gone three terms. So we have three-year election terms. And we've had, you know, National, Labour, then National again, and they've all gone for three terms apiece. But she only went for two, and in terms of personal popularity, at least at some points during her prime ministership, she was higher than most of her predecessors, but it came crashing down. And it was, you know, it got to the point where in sort of the last year of the Labour Party's regime, you could see they thought they had no chance of winning again. And so rather than trying to change their approach, they took on an approach of trying to pass as much of their agenda, even though it was unpopular, as they could, while they still had the chance of being in power. And that's part of the reason that that crashed. But having said that, I think a lot of the polling had National and ACT in New Zealand First coming in lower than they actually came in on election night. So they did surprise on the upside.
But the globalists, their love affair with Jacinta Ardern still continues. Obviously, she had that, what was it called, that semester at Harvard. I can't remember what it was called, where she was there for 6 months. And Hollywood is planning to make a movie about her response to the Christchurch massacre, with Australian actress Rose Byrne playing Jacinta Ardern. She'll need to put in some, I think, fake teeth, and it's going to be written and directed by Andrew Niccol, who is famous for writing The Truman Show and writing and directing Gattaca, that dystopian DNA movie. And it's got some New Zealand taxpayer money lined up into it.
Yeah, 800,000. Was it 800,000? It might be more, actually, of New Zealand taxpayer money being lined up to go into that. And a lot of New Zealanders are unhappy with taxpayer money being going into funding movies and documentaries about politicians, because politicians are, by their nature, a sort of polarizing figures. You know, half the country is going to hate any politician, and probably more than half the country hate Jacinta Ardern at this point. In previous years, we had a similar, although much lower in popularity, scandal about Chloe Swarbrick, who had a taxpayer-funded documentary made about her. And Chloe was just announced as the new co-leader of the Greens today. So look, I mean, Jacinta Ardern still, I mean, probably one of the things that's held up better for her is her international profile. She has a huge international profile, probably much more popular overseas than she is in New Zealand now. But I just don't think New Zealanders want to be putting taxpayer money towards, you know, documentaries or movies about her.
Well, I think you and I both know the job that she really wants one day is Secretary General of the United Nations. I mean, she was a young global socialist leader. I mean, she's still young at 43. So obviously, following in the footsteps of her mentor, Helen Clark, she missed out on the Secretary General job, but she's another New Zealand globalist on the stage, and was another COVID pusher.
Yeah, I mean, it's a well-trodden path now, isn't it? You implement the whims of the globalists in your country, and in return you get a lifetime of riding the gravy train in these global institutions and NGOs. You get very high paying jobs. I mean, she's working with the charities that are linked to the Prince and Princess of Wales. She's over at Harvard doing fake research on misinformation and disinformation, which really just means political views and ideological opinions that she disagrees with.
Trying to censor them. And of course, she and Emmanuel Macron, after the Christchurch massacre, founded the Christchurch Call, which this is what it says on its website, is a community of over 130 governments, online service providers, and civil society organizations acting together to eliminate terrorist and violent extremist content online. Sounds obviously something that everybody could get behind, but the definition of, extremist content, it grows ever larger.
Yeah, well, never let a crisis go to waste, right? So in the wake of the Christchurch call, in the wake of the Christchurch mosque shooting, they set up this initially reasonably sounding thing to prevent future terrorist attacks, or so we were told. But what it's really morphed into is a ideological witch hunt. It's a way of censoring and repressing and demonizing and stigmatizing opinions that they don't like. So initially it focused on sort of far right opinions, but as time has gone on, people have OIA'd this material, investigated the documents associated with it. It's not just far right people they're looking into. It's also critics of immigration, critics of diversity and multiculturalism. And it's even now got to the point where they're calling it gender-based extremism, right? Which is that a woman is a biological category, right, is now an extremist, that you're in the extremist bucket.
A female is, it's based on biology.
Not according to these people. That's what they're saying, is that you're part of a radicalization path pipeline. People who believe, according to this view, which is a silly view, but this is what it is. If you think a woman is a biological thing, then you're on, you know, you're into this radicalization pathway. You're going to read up more about far right ideas. You're going to get into other forms of far right extremism, and you may end up doing a shooting of your own. They're putting people who believe a woman is a biological category into the violent extremist bucket, and their opinions have to be demonized and stigmatized and censored and frowned upon too. The problem is, like, most ordinary people believe that. It's only a very small, as far as I can tell anyway, it's only a very small minority of people that think whether you're a woman or not depends on how you're feeling, you know, like how you feel, whether you feel female or you feel male. Most people don't think of it that way.
Now, the Christchurch call, it seemed to have led to a number of these mis- and disinformation fighting organizations popping up. So one is the Disinformation Project, which said that the promotion of tradwives was part of promoting far-right pro-white politics.
Yeah, well, I mean, this goes back to sort of Marxist ideology, isn't it? Like, it's about marginalizing the normal and normalizing the marginal. It's about inverting people's ideas of what is normal and rational and good, and instead, in their place, putting the marginal and normalizing that. What was the question? Sorry, I've forgotten.
Oh, well, I'll go on.
Oh, you're right. We're talking about FACT and the Disinformation Project.
So FACT it's an acronym for Fight Against Conspiracy Theories.
Yeah. So in what's grown out of the Christchurch call is that the government has decided to take an all-of-society approach to fighting mis- and disinformation. And that means by working with civil society groups to counter mis- and disinformation. And so what they're doing is they're setting up these groups which, you know, aren't formally part of the government, but really they're set up under the at the will of the government. They're just setting them up deliberately at arm's length. So it seems like the government isn't setting up a giant Orwellian circus to give them sort of plausible deniability. But that's what they're doing. And the you know, the DPMC briefing papers, Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, they say this. They're taking an all of society approach to fighting mis- and disinformation. And they're setting up these groups like the Disinformation Project, which received funding from the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment. FACT, I do not know for sure if it's getting government money, but it very well may be. And what these groups are doing is they're taking the views that normal conservative people hold around. It's not even conservative people, people who think that a woman is a biological thing, people who think that too much immigration is bad, people who might be critical of too much diversity, people who are critical of, you know, drag queen story time, things like that. people who don't want their children being taught about, homosexual sex in the schools. And they're trying to say that people who think that are radical extremists, even though a lot of ordinary people, most ordinary people think that. And it's an exercise in demonizing and stigmatizing them to try and intimidate them into shutting up and going along with the program and not speaking out against them. I don't think it's working, but that's the plan.
Well, Dewey Jabal with his new show, the Dialogue on Reality Check Radio, certainly got facts, knickers in a twist, because he managed to get Martin Selner, the Austrian identitarian, on his program, and they call themselves Fact Aotearoa, which is, of course, the Maori name for New Zealand, and they called for government ministers to boycott outlets promoting extreme racist views. And so, of course, they refer to Martin Selner as a far right wing extremist who spearheads neo-fascist movement, identitarian movement Austria. The outlet frequently promotes far right causes and conspiracy theories. And it says here that that Fact Aotearoa calls on Police Minister Mark Mitchell to take a stand and boycott the media outlets promoting someone whose warped racist theories motivated the Christchurch terrorists, because Brent and Tarrant gave a donation and an email to Mountain Selner's organization. And this is another doozy part here. It says they accept that ministers have a right to discuss government policies where they can, but Red Chick Radio's promotion of Martin Selner crosses the line. Like, the line is just something that they arbitrarily invented so they can control what is and isn't allowed to be spoken about.
Yeah, well, I mean, Martin Selner was only ever tangentially connected to Brent and Tarrant, from what I understand. It's a real stretch. Do you know the details on that?
Well, just like I said, he gave a donation and sent an email, which, of course, Martin Selner probably gets, he gets lots of donations and lots of emails. We had in Australia, he gave a donation to one of our nationalist figures, Blair Cottrell, and also wrote a comment calling him the God Emperor. And so, of course, he was accused of inspiring Brenton Tarrant as well.
But, I mean, why did Brenton Tarrant do what he did? I mean, he did it in part, it may even be the main reason he did it, was to get attention for his manifesto, right? And the reason he thought he had to resort to such extreme methods to do it is because the ideas he were trying to spread was so censored. So, I mean, what are these people arguing for? They're arguing for more censorship. It may have been what caused the problem in the first place. It may have been what caused him to do the attack, because he couldn't spread his ideas through the normal channels. So he tried to resort to violence to get a whole bunch of attention as a sort of another way of doing it. So these people who are concerned about terrorist attacks and preventing violence, they really need to ask themselves, is what I'm doing making it more or less likely that someone is going to commit a terrorist attack like this? Because if Brent and Tarrant could have just used the normal technology like we're able to do now, because, Elon Musk has made Twitter much more free speech friendly. If that was available when Brent and Tarrant was writing his manifesto and trying to distribute it or whatever he was trying to do, it may not have occurred to him that he had to commit a terrorist attack. And so, really, I just want to challenge the people who think that censoring, suppressing, trying to shut down opposing ideas, I want to challenge them to say, is that approach really going to make it less likely that terrorist attacks happen, or is it going to make it more likely? Really think hard about this, because I'm not sure you've got it the right way around.
Or Brett and Terrence just not right in the head, because people who commit.
Well, he's not, obviously, but it's still there's enough rationality there that he can think through strategically what's like more likely to spread his message.
Well, I don't know if fact. Well, they also teamed up with Stuff to do a hit piece. They called Reality Check Radio Way, a fringe radio station that chats with ministers and conspiracy theorists alike. And to Christopher Luxon's credit, he said he wanted his ministers to talk to be available to as many media outlets as possible. And Reality Check Radio hit back, and well, they said it was the Stuff piece was a hysterical anti-free speech campaign by far left lobby group Fact Aotearoa and Stuff. And it says their crusade didn't go to plan, with the PM and other MPs instead making remarks about the need for plurality in the media. And they've invited Fact to come on to RCR to discuss their outrage and the shocking Selner interview at the heart of the kerfuffle, which I'll put the link into the live chat. And Martin Selner, he has just been allowed back on Twitter X, which is excellent. It's all in, obviously, German, but you can translate it. He is married a lot of people might remember to Brittany Pettibone, who's an American. So I don't know if Dewey's responsible for getting Martin Selner back on Twitter X, but yeah, it's backfired on Fact.
Yeah, well, Martin Selner's big idea is remigration, and it's simply the idea that you know, the large, in his context, the large Muslim migrations into Europe aren't working out so well, and more of them are coming. And so what we need to do is address the push-pull factors that are causing people to come in and see if you can reverse them so that some of those people can go out again. How unreasonable is that, really? If people have come in and they're causing a problem and they're not assimilating into your society, and in fact, they view themselves as enemies of your society, maybe it's not a good idea that they're there in the first place. And changing the incentives so that they are willing to leave again, there's nothing, what's unreasonable about that?
And the alternative for Deutschland in Germany proper, they have talked about a repatriation of non-integrated mass migrants. One of the AfD leaders, Staffer, was sacked for meeting Martin Selner. So they're sort of still, well, they obviously got to be careful that there's not a high court challenge to ban them, because it's abused the German constitutional ban on national socialism to try and ban any nationalist party.
Yeah, we have to ban certain political parties from operating with it in order to save democracy.
That's just
ridiculous, isn't it? Like, you know, look, the policies that have been the reason that the so-called far right, which is really not as far right as people are making it out to be, but the reason that they are gaining more public support and more getting more people into governments right across the Western world. I mean, we're seeing this is a phenomenon that's going on right across the Western world. We've seen it with Trump. We saw it with Brexit. Geert Wilders in the Netherlands is getting elected. The AfD is making strides in Germany. Marine Le Pen, I saw polling the other day that she would win a presidential race in France. You know, we've got a much more right-wing government than we had in New Zealand now. This is a pan-Western phenomenon, and it represents the will of the people. right? It represents the will of the people. People are turning to these parties because the established parties, their policies have failed, and people are rejecting them, and people are looking for new solutions to the problems that these established parties have caused. And they're turning to these so-called far-right parties because they seem to have solutions. Like, they talk about migration, for example. Migration is causing legitimate problems in Western societies. And so, of course, politicians and parties that talk about that as a problem are going to become more popular. The left's answer to this isn't to change any of their policies. It's merely to try and demonize and ban their opponents, which is anti-democratic, isn't it?
Well, stuff used to be owned by the former Australian newspaper company Fairfax, which is now merged with Channel 9 here, and they sold it for $1, which showed just how much they wanted to get rid of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're back to the fragmentation of media. Because the way people are consuming media has fragmented, and they're getting their media through so many different mediums now, it makes it harder and harder to get those eyeballs that the advertisers need into any one medium. And really, for a lot of these, unless you've got a pay-to-view type platform, advertising dollars is what really keeps it afloat. And it's getting harder and harder for any one platform to capture the advertising buck. And so, I mean, these platforms, they have, you know, overheads and fixed costs that require a certain amount of advertising money to keep them afloat. And if they can't meet that, they go bust.
I should also mention that News Hub is owned by Warner Brothers Discovery, which owns CNN. So that company has well-established expertise in running news organizations into the ground.
Yeah, I mean, New Zealand's a little country at the end of the world, and that's a big global media company. So it's not like what happens in New Zealand is going to be a high priority for them. And if the news business really isn't making any money, that's small potatoes for them. Why would they keep it going? But what it does mean is that the resources, the infrastructure, the journalists, the systems they've got set up there, they're not all going to go away just because the owners have decided that it's not a profitable enterprise anymore. And so there is an opportunity for another player to come in and invest and, you know, take it over. And that's something that may happen. I don't know whether it will happen, because it may just be that traditional journalism isn't profitable anymore. This proliferation of new media and proliferation of different ways people are consuming the news. But it's possible a new owner could come in and set up a new operation to take on One News and TVNZ before June, when they've said they're going to shut down. We'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Though the independent alternative media, and that has filled the market that the mainstream media continues to have contempt for. So there's not just Reality Check Radio, there's a platform founded by Sean Plunkett, there's the BFD, which used to be Whale Oil Beef Hooks. So there has been, over many years now, a uncatered for market, it seems that the mainstream media outlets would just prefer to die, or they've got a few other tricks left up their sleeve. I mean, I'm sure that we have in Australia a proposed mis and disinformation bill our communications media authority can order social media companies to take down the so-called mis and disinformation. And definition of harm can mean, well, a harm to the health or the environment, or hatred against any group in Australia based on ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, age, gender, religion, or physical or mental disability. We also, the definition of mis- and disinformation that is likely to contribute to serious harm, you know, these sorts of broad definitions. We already had the previous Morrison government pass the Online Safety Act, which gives our e-safety commissioner, Julie Immangrant, she's going after Twitter X, fining them $687,000 a day because they're not explaining to her how they're implementing online safety expectations. What's the regulation environment in New Zealand?
Well, we don't have an equivalent of the Mis- and Disinformation Bill. What we do have is what I explained earlier, which is an all-of-society approach to fighting mis- and disinformation, with the government setting up these groups like the Disinformation Project, in fact, and indeed a whole bunch of other groups that they're giving seed funding to. So there's that. But in addition to that, we've got something passing through the parliament now called the Fair News Digital Bargaining Bill.
Yes.
And this is analogous to what you guys have in Australia and what Canada has as well, which is a bill that would require the mainstream news companies, or would require the big social media platforms, the big internet platforms like Google and Facebook and some other ones, to negotiate with the New Zealand's news providers and pay them some amount of money, which they would negotiate to host their content. Yeah. And so in Australia, and I think in Canada too, in response, the Facebook has just said, well, in Australia, I think it's Facebook, that they've just said, well, we're not going to run news on their platform anymore.
You don't blame them, obviously. You know, we're no fans of Facebook. But the whole thing is that these media outlets utilize Facebook and Google to drive content through their websites. So they're the ones posting their own content on Facebook and Google, and obviously using their influence on government. So it's the most perverse thing ever. I mean, the reason people are finding their news online is through Google and Facebook. So actually, it's Facebook and Google that are doing them the favor.
Well, yeah, if they were being ripped off, they wouldn't put their news up there, would they? But they do, because it drives people, it gets views and clicks. So it's obviously benefiting them. The issue really is the new technology. Which means they don't have as much market share and they don't have as much eyeballs to sell to the advertisers as they used to. And because they now have to compete with new providers. And really, they would have reduced the problem for themselves had they merely tried to cater to the conservative half of the population. You know, you can afford to lecture people when you've got a monopoly on provision and there's no conservative providers to cater to their worldviews, because people still need to have a rough idea what's going on. So they'll listen to your news, even if they sort of a bit pissed off by your, left-wing bias. But when there are other options available, which is what we have now, first with social media, then internet news, and now with these new providers that have set up, like in New Zealand, like you say, The Platform and Reality Check Radio. Once you have these new providers there, then that's competition. And those new providers are actually growing. They're gaining new eyeballs. And it's exposed how biased the media was. Before, we might not have totally realized how biased they were because there was no comparison of what it could have been otherwise. So they've been exposed as to how biased they are. And now they've got serious competition from a different worldview. So I don't know how they're going to go back.
And you don't have Murdoch media in New Zealand, which obviously the left love, but that has meant that there's been this not a mass media organization like Rupert Murdoch. Basically, the key to his success as a newsman was catering to audiences who were ignored, whether it be his newspapers in Australia or Fox News in the United States.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was a big, back in the day, I was a big Fox News fan because it catered to a more conservative worldview. But what we have now in many ways is even better. You can find, if you search out different news providers online, you can find different providers of news that cater specifically to the way you think. Now, there are good and bad things to that. It is helpful to be challenged by different worldviews from time to time. But it is good to have someone providing you with news who isn't like hostile to your basic worldview.
Oh, yes, certainly. Now, I thought I'd finish off by as somebody who lives and works in New Zealand. Where actually are you in New Zealand? What city?
So I'm near Wellington. I live in Lower Hutt.
So your government is just, new government is over 2 months old. Certainly from over here, we're impressed. The fact that, the nanny state generational smoking ban, that's been overturned. You have the trans ban in female sports, the rolling back of sex education you're talking about, teaching children homosexual sex. Obviously, you're living it and consuming the daily politics. So what report card do you give them so far?
I think it's largely positive. I mean, maybe I'm being generous. There are certainly things you can criticize, but I mean, you have to remember that this is a mainstream, these are mainstream political parties, right? There's three of them, right? So there's the National Party, which is a mainstream center-right party. Then there's the ACT Party, which is more of a libertarian type party. And there's New Zealand First, which is sort of an economically centrist but socially conservative and kind of nationalistic anti-immigration party, or at least it has been anti-immigration in the past. And they put together quite one of the most comprehensive, I think, coalition agreements we've seen in quite a while, with a reasonably detailed, a large number of policy points that all parties agreed on. And that looks great. That coalition agreement was great. It had lots of things that appealed to lots of people, and especially things that people had been talking about in conservative circles on social media. So that was great. And they put together a 100-day plan, which is now, the 100 days is now up. And I think they ticked off almost everything on their 100-day plan. And so that's great. There is, I sense, from the Prime Minister, Chris Luxon, a bit of a reluctance to get involved too much in some of the more controversial social and cultural issues. But on the positive side, his two deputies, the leaders of the other two parties, ACT and New Zealand First, so Winston Peters and David Seymour, respectively, they seem to have more of a free rein in Luxon has given them a free rein in terms of their public comments. And so it's quite an interesting setup where the two smaller parties are able to say things that are sort of a little bit at odds sometimes with the main party. And I think we're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out and whether they implement all of the things that they said they would in the coalition agreement. But the signs are positive.
Well, both David Seymour and Winston Peters campaigned on rolling back co-governance, which my last New Zealand guest last year before your election was Julian Batchelor, who, of course, went on that national tour against co-governance, which was implemented by stealth. And I know that his events were constantly picketed. Is that the sort of issue which Chris Luxon is sort of dragged to the rollback of the different, because it means different, like these unelected Maori groups get a say on various government bodies and institutions?
There does appear to be some reluctance there. Part of what they agreed in the coalition agreement was for a bill to redefine what the treaty principles are. So New Zealand has the Treaty of Waitangi. It was agreed between the Crown and Maori in 1847 or something. I've probably got the year wrong, or something like that. And it was actually a reasonable document and very simple. Maori ceded sovereignty to the Queen. They got to keep their traditional property, and they got all the rights of British citizens. Very simple. Those are the three articles. That's what they say. But we've had a sort of activist judges who have sought to reinterpret the treaty over sort of the previous decades to say that the treaty means a partnership, and that Maori never really ceded sovereignty, even though that's explicitly what the treaty says they did. And so these things called the treaty principles, which are made up things made up by judges, have snuck their way into lots of legislation. And, you know, I used to work in the public sector. Everyone always talked about the treaty principles, and you know, every piece of legislation you're discussing or every briefing, you always had to say what the treaty implications of everything were. Yes. So it was just getting out of hand. So this government's going to draft a bill, but they're only going to, the other two parties apart from ACT are only going to support it to the first reading of a select committee. But what this looks like to me is they're setting up for a big constitutional discussion on what the role of the treaty is in New Zealand and what it will be going forward. And I think that's a good thing and a healthy discussion to have, because the treaty has really been used and leveraged by left-wing Maori groups to support sort of grievance politics, Marxist grievance politics, and to underpin this co-governance idea, which is very unpopular with most New Zealanders and contributed to Labour's election loss. So hopefully we get to have this constitutional discussion, and hopefully we get, as a result of it, a rethinking of the trajectory we had been on with these treaty principles, and moving us more towards Maori grievance politics. Hopefully we reverse that, and we get back towards more what the treaty said originally. And I think that would bring us together as New Zealanders, and would be a good outcome.
It still sounds all very promising, which is, well, it's refreshing for us here in Australia. I mean, obviously our Albanese government here, Labour government, is very into identity politics. Obviously, they push the Aboriginal voice. And there's a whole bunch of other anti-freedom laws that have passed under this government. So I have said that New Zealand, it could be the place for some Aussies to flee. Well, normally it's the other way around. New Zealanders come to Australia, although what's the old joke? They come here for the welfare.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys are still ahead of us in terms of average incomes and salaries and things like that. So that's a pretty big pull factor.
But well, we've got obviously the mining industry, which New Zealand basically maintains its first world living standards by milk and wine.
You know, but we can mine too if we really wanted to. And that's another promising thing that the coalition government is talking about. They're talking about doing more oil exploration. They're talking about getting back into mining and exploiting some of our natural resources, because you know, a lot of that stuff got shut down under the previous Labor government due to environmentalism, out of control environmentalism. The new government seems to be very positive towards reopening those industries again. And I think that can only be positive. Small countries like New Zealand, the ones that do well, often do well because of their primary industries and their resource extraction. Big countries can do well because they get into, you know, these big service industries and manufacturing, but you need critical mass to really be good at those sorts of things. So smaller countries, if they can exploit their natural resources, that can be a good strategy towards wealth and high living standards. And so I think it's a good thing to get back into that.
Yeah, maybe you'll strike some black gold, which I know you'd certainly welcome. It's been great to chat with you tonight, William. I appreciate you staying up so late. It is getting close to midnight over there, so I'll let you head off now. So your Twitter X profile I will put into the live chat there. So if you want to see it's mainly you post the worst of New Zealand politics. What is it? The Greens have got a new co-deputy leader. They lost one of their MPs for being a serial shoplifter. So they're in all sorts of mess.
Yeah, I mean, I try and just give commentary about all the things that are going on in New Zealand politics. And I try and do a bit of analysis too, of, you know, what sort of philosophical beliefs or trends or policies are really going on, motivating a lot of this sort of stuff. So try and get a wee bit deeper than the mainstream news gets. So hopefully that's enlightening to people.
Oh, well, all the best, and we'll definitely keep in touch, and I continue to check your feed to see what's happening in the media political world of New Zealand.
Thanks, Tom. It's been a real pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. That's the end of this edition of the Wilmsfront Featured Interview Program. Now, of course, I will be back tomorrow night for Tim's News Explosion, where I will cover all of the latest developments here in Australia, including, the drama that has been made here in Victoria with the Labor Day weekend heat wave, with the city of Melbourne deciding to cancel the Moomba parade, obviously trying to sort of make a statement about climate crisis. Then we'll also have the crime report, because there has been some more horrific crime that has occurred, and including the arrest and the disappearance of Ballarat mother Samantha Murphy. Also got the sports report, which will be spearheaded by Matilda's Sam Kerr's alleged anti-white slur at a London PC cop. And also we'll check in what's happening in the UK with Jeremy Hunt's spring budget, and also Biden's State of the Union in the United States, and Trump's reaction to it. So that will be all tomorrow. Now, as I mentioned, I appear weekly on Reality Check Radio on its breakfast program every Tuesday with Paul Brennan. I still post the shows onto the Unshackled website, so you can find them. I'll put the link into the live chat there. So that is every Tuesday. And also, Dewey DeBoer's dialogue show is every Friday. So he has already, got a number of headlines for his interviews. So it's great to see him doing well and getting good reviews from both listeners of Reality Check Radio and also from his critics as well, which is what you want. So remember, if you want to support the work of the Unshackled, you can take out an Unshackled membership at the unshackled.net/membership. So we have premium membership for $5 per month, silver $10 per month, gold $25 per month, platinum $50 per month. And then, of course, you can also subscribe to the Unshackled's Substack. That's where I now post and email the Unshackled's productions, including Wilms Front, Tim's News Explosion, the report from Tiger Mountain. So you can choose a monthly membership, $5 per month, i.e. annual $50 per month, or founding member for $500 a year. So that's at theunshackled.substack.com/subscribe. So I'll see you tomorrow night for another epic Tim's News Explosion. Thank you for joining me tonight. Until then, I would say stay safe, stay cool. I mean, it's pretty easy to stay cool. I mean, to avoid getting heat stroke, there's this thing called water. You go and drink it when you're getting a bit too hot, like comes out of the tap, or you can buy a bottle. It's pretty easy. So there we go. I will see you all tomorrow night there'll probably be another heat meltdown from the governments and the climate hysterics again tomorrow. So until then, good night, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to Wilmsfront. Visit timwilms.com to view the archive of episodes. And keep visiting theunshackled.net to view all our shows. And to keep up with the latest real news and analysis,